From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, recent developments in the treatment and diagnosis of breast cancer. We talk with Dr. Elisa Port, author of the New Generation Breast Cancer book.
It would be much harder for me as a person to take care of a kind of cancer where there weren't so many amazing options for treatment and there wasn't as much room for optimism.
Dr. Port will talk about genetic testing, 3D mammograms, customized chemo, mastectomies, and breast reconstruction. Also, we remember actor, producer, and playwright Jack Larson. He died Sunday at 87. He was best known for playing Jimmy Olsen on the Superman TV series in the 50s.
How many times were you kidnapped as Jimmy Olsen?
I don't know, probably every third show I was kidnapped as Jimmy and had a bomb at my feet.
And Maureen Corrigan reviews Lauren Groff's new novel. That's on Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, I want to tell you about a new NPR podcast called Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam. It premieres September 22nd with an episode exploring a phenomenon called switch tracking, when two people think they're talking about the same thing, but in reality are speeding down separate tracks. It usually does not end well. You can subscribe to Hidden Brain on the NPR One app, iTunes, or at npr.org/podcasts. The survival rate for women with breast cancer is higher than ever, approaching 90%. We're going to talk about recent improvements in diagnosing and treating breast cancer and in breast reconstruction with Dr. Elisa Port, author of the new book, The New Generation Breast Cancer Book. She's chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York and director of its Dubin Breast Center. Dr. Elisa Port, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the most cutting-edge development you're currently using?
There's a variety of different things going on. The cure rates from breast cancer have never been better. And while, of course, it is still a potentially lethal disease, we're doing better than ever before with all different subtypes of breast cancer. And that's mostly related to research advances. And so, obviously, drug development targeted at very, very specific tumor types. We can look at a woman and her individual tumor and try to customize and personalize treatments for her particular case. I can give you an example of that. There's a test that's commercially available called the Oncotype test, and that's a test that we frequently do for subsets of women with breast cancer to help us decide. It's basically a tumor profile test. We take a snippet of their tumor, and a genetic profile is run on that tumor to tell us a little bit more about how it's behaving biologically. And, for example, it can give us very personalized information for a woman that looked like she had a relatively indolent cancer, telling us, no, it's really behaving more aggressively than we would expect, and perhaps we want to treat that person more aggressively in turn with chemotherapy, that sort of thing. Alternatively, it could give us the opposite information. So some of these tests are really almost standard of care and more widely available. Some of them are being done at only the top tier centers.
When you are profiling a tumor, do you then test it with different forms of chemo to see which chemo can effectively attack the tumor?
This is definitely the wave of the future. We actually do that. We take snippets of tissue from women who have a more biologically aggressive form of breast cancer. It's known as triple negative breast cancer. And we're taking actually a snippet of that tumor and trying to grow it out in animal models and in cell models where we can potentially try out different types of chemotherapy to see what the response rate is before actually giving that to the person.
Mammograms have become a little more confusing because there are choices now. There's more than just the conventional mammogram X-ray. There's now 3D mammograms. Mm-hmm. There's the options of MRIs and possibly even sonograms. Can you just give us an overview of when you might want to do something other than the conventional mammogram?
Sure. I think this is a real hot button issue because there's so many mixed messages that are being sent to women across this country. Mammograms are definitely the most effective way to pick up breast cancer for the general population. And that's why the current recommendations are that every woman get screened with a mammogram starting at age 40. Period. End of discussion. Okay. That said, every person is different and their risk factors are different, and there absolutely may be a role for adding on to the mammogram, not instead of, for women depending on their risk level, their breast density, and again, their underlying health.
Why don't you describe what the 3D mammogram is?
Sure.
It's a relatively new option for women.
Yeah.
And it's not being prescribed for everyone. It's select women.
So 3D mammography is kind of a software update to conventional imaging where basically for a slightly higher dose of radiation, it takes multiple pictures through the breast. And you have to envision it. The way I explain it to women is it's almost like it's different paging through a book. So rather than generating one image in one direction and a second image in the other direction, you get multiple images, slices through the breast. And the thing that it's most helpful with is reducing the risk of what we call false positives. So saying there's something there when there really isn't, based on tissue overlap. So if you see a dense piece of tissue in one part of the breast and a dense piece of tissue in another part of the breast, and those lie over each other in one view, it may look doubly dense. When you take these sheets of tissue...
It may look like a tumor is what you're saying.
Yes, it absolutely can mimic looking like a tumor. And then what 3D mammogram can help with is separating out these pieces of tissue. So as you look at them individually, you realize it was just a summation effect of all these things overlapped, and really there's nothing there. In some cases, it can pick up cancers that mammograms miss. And overall, it's probably better than a regular mammogram or what's called a digital mammogram.
Now, what about an MRI? When do you think an MRI of the breast is called for?
MRI is a test that is very sensitive for picking up breast cancer. It's a test that's done with an IV injection where you receive a dye called gadolinium that circulates through the body, and it's picked up by areas of high blood flow. And one of the things that cause high blood flow is cancer. Cancer cells are growing and dividing very rapidly, and those involve increased blood flow in general. So MRIs are exquisitely sensitive to pick up cancer. So the question arises, why not MRIs for everyone? And the answer is because they are associated with a substantial risk of false positives. You do an MRI, you know, 14 things light up in the breast, and that generates a lot of anxiety, a lot of unnecessary biopsies, and so forth. And so MRIs are generally reserved for screening women at the highest risk for breast cancer. We have to be really judicious with the ordering of MRIs. And those of us who do this for a living just have seen this play out time and time again. You know, you don't want to order an MRI as a knee-jerk kind of response. And you want to think through what the possible outcomes are in each individual patient.
Because you don't want it to lead to a lot of unnecessary testing.
Correct. Right.
Yeah. And scaring of women.
Of course. And unnecessarily when there's very little added benefit.
Yeah.
So obviously in the women who are at the highest risk for breast cancer, we worry more in those women about missing a cancer. And so the bar is much lower for doing these imaging studies, et cetera. And so we do. Again, it goes back to our theme, and it's one of the themes in the book, you know, of it's not a one-size-fits-all world anymore. And we, you know, those of us who do this for a living know or try as best we can to customize approaches for each individual person.
One of your specialties as a surgeon is the sentinel lymph node biopsy. And
sure.
You've written about it, too, in papers. So why don't you explain what the lymph node biopsy is in relation to breast cancer?
Sure. Finding out if breast cancer has spread to the lymph nodes is one of the single most important pieces of information. So in the old days, the only way of finding out if the lymph nodes were involved was to make a big cut under the arm and remove the nodes under the arm. So as tumors got smaller and smaller, that led to some very smart people saying, gosh, I wonder if there's a way to check the nodes under the arm without actually removing them all. Maybe we can just remove a couple of the lymph nodes, and that would be a good indicator as to whether or not the rest are involved. And then if those nodes are okay, we can leave the rest alone. So what sentinel node involves is that prior to surgery, a woman undergoes an injection of dye into her breast. And that dye travels to along what's called the lymphatic pathways to a couple of nodes under the arm. And what that dye travel shows us is if this cancer is going to spread, here's where it's going to go first. These node or nodes, and it's usually one or two or three, are the gatekeepers for the rest of the lymph nodes under that arm. And if you make a little cut, not a big one anymore, and pluck out those select nodes, and those are okay, the rest are okay too. And you've basically reduced the degree of surgery that you have to do.
Let's talk about mastectomies. A lot has changed with mastectomies. I would ask you about who should get a lumpectomy versus a mastectomy, but I think that's so specific probably to each individual patient. I'm not sure how useful a more general discussion of that would be. Or do you tell me?
Well, I think there are long and short answers for this question, and I think the most important thing that women know is that there are both medical reasons why a woman needs one or the other and personal reasons why a woman could choose one or the other. And that is the epicenter of my job on a daily basis, is working with a woman and giving her sort of the medical input and then saying these are your safe options. And women don't always have all of the options open to them.
So are there specific guidelines for when a mastectomy is absolutely required?
Sure. To give you a couple of general examples, a woman who has a large amount of cancer in her breast, where from a technical standpoint, it would be very difficult to do a smaller operation, make a small incision, get an area out, get what we call clear margins, the whole area out, and leave her with a result that she's happy with, that's one very, very common reason why we would recommend a mastectomy. Another, and this is a little bit more of a moving target, is in general, a woman who has, even if the areas are small, in general, when more than one area of cancer is found in the breast, a mastectomy is usually recommended. Although in selected cases, people are starting to do what we call double lumpectomies, although generally it's not the standard of care.
When you're performing a mastectomy and your patient wants reconstruction, you're working with a plastic surgeon. What do you have to do as the breast surgeon to make sure that the cancer is gone, the breast is removed, but the breast is ready for reconstruction?
Yeah. That's the years of training, which is walking the fine line between, of course, the number one priority, which is making sure all the cancer's out. No one wants to go through that extent of operation and recovery and so forth, and then risk leaving cancer behind or an appreciable amount of breast tissue behind that could then form a new cancer. So, of course, the number one goal is cancer. But, of course, we want to balance this with the aesthetic concerns. And this is often, this is often a battle in terms of making sure that we do the first, but also maximizing the chances of a good cosmetic result. For sure, my job is to remove as much breast tissue that I can. Often we try to make our incisions really strategically located and as small as we can. And obviously it's our job as breast surgeons to make sure that we're not compromising the results of cancer removal. When you make a really small incision, it can make it more difficult to remove the breast tissue that's far away from that incision. You just can't reach. And so we have to be really clear about what our goals are and really stick to our guns sometimes about making sure that we're not compromising the cancer part or the cancer priority.
So when your patient is having reconstructive surgery and they're mm-hmm. doing it with an implant, mm-hmm. you keep the original breast skin to
yes.
cover the implant?
Yes, absolutely. So in general, most mastectomies that are done, especially those with reconstruction, are what are called skin-sparing mastectomies, where we can make really relatively small incisions. If we are removing the nipple, we go above the nipple and below the nipple with our small incisions and remove the small ellipse of tissue, remove all of the breast through there. We can even check the nodes through that incision and leave the vast majority and preserve the vast majority of the skin envelope, where then at the same surgery, a plastic surgeon comes in with an implant or a smaller version, a temporary implant, what we called a tissue expander, and can inflate that to a degree that fills out that remaining skin envelope.
And that requires coming back several times for further surgeries?
Yes. So in general, you know, it can be challenging for the plastic surgeons, although many are able to do it, and it's obviously, again, on a case-by-case basis. It can be challenging to put the full-size implant in at the same time as the mastectomy surgery. And that's for a couple of reasons. You know, the skin that after you do a mastectomy, the skin needs to heal. And it's somewhat traumatized from obviously removing the breast tissue beneath it because that is the source of a large amount of its blood supply. And one of the things that can put further tension and pressure on that skin and affect wound healing is if you put a full-size implant under there, that puts a lot of tension on the skin. So in many, many cases, putting the smaller tissue expander is advantageous because it really gives the skin a chance to recover without being under tension. And then over time, 2-3 weeks after surgery, an injection of saline into that temporary expander fills it out a little bit, and gradually the skin is stretched so that it can adapt every step of the way.
When you have successful reconstructive surgery through the more standard procedure, which is with the implants, how sensitive is the breast tissue to the touch following healing?
Right. You mean the overlying skin, because theoretically there shouldn't be.
Right.
Yeah. It's a really important point. And it is whether, I think one of the main points, you know, we're doing more and more nipple preservation mastectomies now. But I think the key point that I have to make sure I inform women of is that whether you save the nipple, you don't save the nipple, most of the sensation is gone. And that's because the nerve endings that come through with the breast tissue are by and large removed. So for the most part, there is a lot of numbness in that area. And for every woman, it's sort of very gradual. When you start out, for example, touching the clavicle, they can feel that, which is your collarbone. And as you move down the chest after a mastectomy, it varies from person to person as to where the sensation ends and the numbness begins. But it's a really important part of my kind of, the consultation. Women, you know, it would be natural to assume that if you save the appearance of the nipple, you'd be saving sensation when you really aren't in most cases.
I know some women who have cancer in one breast and need a mastectomy wonder if they should have a mastectomy of the other breast because they fear that the cancer will spread to the other side. How frequently does that actually happen? That the cancer jumps to the other side.
Yeah, this is really one of the most important, a great opportunity to clarify what risks a woman has and, of course, the reasons for both for and against removing the other breast. So, to answer your question, the most important thing for a woman to know is that when she has breast cancer on one side, breast cancer can spread. It can spread to other parts of the body. It does not spread to the other breast. So women can develop a new separate cancer in the other side, but for most women, that likelihood is extremely low, and most women do tend to overestimate their risks of getting a new cancer on the other side. Also critically important to know is that the removal of the other healthy breast in no way reduces a woman's chances of the cancer that they have, particularly an invasive cancer, spreading. So there's really no difference in survival between removing the other healthy breast and not.
My guest is Dr. Elisa Port, author of the New Generation Breast Cancer book and chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. After we take a short break, we'll talk about who should get genetic testing to see if they're at high risk for breast cancer. Then we'll listen back to an interview with Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen on the 1950s TV series The Adventures of Superman. He died Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from PBS. Travel to Africa to experience the rewilding of a paradise once decimated by war. In this unprecedented project, filmmakers, scientists, and local rangers join forces to build an inspirational new beginning and create a model for rehabilitating the world's endangered wild places. Gorongosa Park, Rebirth of Paradise, premieres Tuesday, September 22nd at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And streaming now on PBS Anywhere platforms.
Who would you recommend get genetic testing to see if they have the BRCA gene that would mean they face a higher likelihood of getting cancer?
It is kind of a moving target. The groups of people, like the red flag situations where we think genetic testing may be appropriate, keeps expanding. But here are some of the big ones. Women who are diagnosed with breast cancer premenopausally, usually, in their 20s, 30s, 40s especially, who have a family history of other premenopausal breast cancers, women who have combined family histories of both breast and ovarian cancer, any family where there's a history of male breast cancer. And I think one of the important things to know is not that it's exclusive at all, but the gene is way more common in what's called Ashkenazi Jewish women, so women of European descent. So nowadays, pretty much any Jewish woman diagnosed with actual breast cancer can and should be tested. And the number of Ashkenazi Jewish women who have the gene, which is shocking to some people, is actually 1 in 40. So a full 2% of the Ashkenazi Jewish population actually has the BRCA gene, whereas in the general population, it's more like 1 in 400. So it's 10 times more common. So as you can imagine, any Ashkenazi Jewish woman diagnosed with breast cancer is getting tested. There's even some initiatives afoot to test Ashkenazi Jewish women, even if they don't have breast cancer, with the idea being that if 1 in 40 are going to be found to have this gene, there may be options for those women for prevention that they would not have known about.
But what kind of tough choices do you have to make if you've tested positive for the gene but you don't have cancer?
In general, there are two main options over the course of time for those people, and it's very, very individually based. One option is what we call surveillance. Remember, we talked a little bit about MRIs, etc. This is a group where MRIs are critical, and in general, most of these women, BRCA-positive women, who have possibly an upwards of 80% chance of getting breast cancer in their lifetimes would be screened very aggressively. Usually we do mammograms once a year, and we do MRIs once a year, and we split them up. So for example, a mammogram could be done every January, and an MRI could be done every July, so they're getting tested twice a year. We do physical exams on these people so that, God forbid, 2 months after a mammogram, they develop a lump, what's called an interval cancer. We ideally could pick that up early. Unfortunately, the only other option is really on the complete other end of the spectrum, which is what we call bilateral mastectomy or risk-reducing mastectomy. The only true way of preventing breast cancer and BRCA mutation carriers is by removing the tissue at risk. And so these are two diametrically opposed options and obviously need to be weighed on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, timing for one of the things we talk about in the book is ideal timing for one woman may be too early or too late for another. And it can have a lot to do with where women are at in their lives, et cetera, and how they feel about themselves and so forth.
Do you lean toward the let's watch carefully and monitor you direction and as opposed to the double mastectomy direction?
No, I definitely don't. You know, there are two genes, the BRCA1 and the BRCA2. In general, for those women who develop breast cancer with BRCA1, the tumors can be quite aggressive. Even the earliest, smallest cancers can be aggressive and life-threatening. So sometimes when a woman says to me, you know, I'm going to just have mammograms and MRIs, and then when something develops, you'll pick it up early, right? And I turn around and say, you know, the problem with these BRCA genes is that early detection is a goal. It's not a guarantee. And even the earliest cancer detected in a BRCA mutation carrier can be something that is A, associated with a risk of death, B, may need chemotherapy, and C, you know, may be associated with all kinds of other downstream effects. So for the woman who is interested in the watchful waiting approach, these are all important considerations to make.
Since the BRCA gene is more likely to show up in women who are Ashkenazi Jews, do you always recommend to your patients who are Ashkenazi Jews that they get tested for the gene?
Many of them, yes. You know, I think one of the most tricky things about the mutation is that the mutation can be handed down on either a mother or a father's side of the family. So imagine, if you will, that I'm an Ashkenazi Jew and my father, and of course men don't get ovarian cancer and very few get breast cancer, although some do, of course, and make believe my father had the gene, but it traveled silently in him. And make believe he only had one brother. And make believe the gene came through their father. You could see how I, quote unquote, have no family history of breast cancer, and then I develop breast cancer at age 35, and they test me and find out, lo and behold, I'm BRCA positive. How did that happen without any family history of breast or ovarian cancer? And it happened because I have a family with very few women on that side of my family. And so the gene can be very deceptive and very tricky and travel surreptitiously in families. So I do set the bar very, very low for testing in anyone where it may be traveling.
But, you know, that does lead to a lot of potential double mastectomies. Probably in some women who never would have had cancer. So you're kind of opening the door to mental suffering and to, you know, very invasive surgery.
Sure. I mean, I think this is a very controversial area, but understand with the BRCA gene, it is one situation. No one's advocating, you know, I certainly am not doing double mastectomies on women without the gene. You know, I have never really done that in any appreciable numbers preventatively. I mean, the cases are very, very few and far between. But what we're saying is that if you are found to be a BRCA mutation carrier, the likelihood that you will get breast cancer over your lifetime, and keep in mind, we never know with any individual person when that shoe is going to fall, you know, And so the timing is difficult to determine as well. The risk of ovarian cancer is also incredibly important. Ovarian cancer is a disease that is usually caught much later than breast cancer. As I like to say, there is no really early detection of ovarian cancer. There's no mammogram for the ovaries. And so at the very least for these women, we can talk about ovarian removal after they're done with childbearing. And avoid that very lethal disease.
Because the BRCA gene also leaves you more likely to get ovarian cancer.
Correct. The risk of getting ovarian cancer with the BRCA gene is anywhere from 20 to 40% with the BRCA1 and maybe up to 20% with the BRCA2, and earlier onset with the BRCA1, later onset with the BRCA2.
I imagine you've had to tell a lot of women that they have cancer.
Yes.
What does that take out of you to have to convey so many times such bad news?
I wish I could say it got easier as it goes along, but it certainly doesn't. And there's degrees of it, it affects me every single time. But it is what we're trained to do. And I think for me personally, the only redeeming part is that that's followed very closely by, and here's what we're going to do to make you better. I think it would be much harder for me as a person to take care of a kind of cancer where there weren't so many amazing options for treatment and there wasn't as much room for optimism. And I think for me personally, that is what keeps me going.
If you don't mind my asking, do you worry about getting breast cancer yourself?
I do, of course, as a woman. I don't think I do obsessively. I have a complicated family history, but we don't have a huge breast cancer component in our family. But, the average woman's risk is 10% over her lifetime. And I think obsessively about it, but I do what I have to do to make sure I'm being checked. Exactly what I would recommend for, I do for myself what, I do for my patients exactly what I would do for myself.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it and I was so appreciative of the opportunity.
Dr. Elisa Port is the author of the New Generation Breast Cancer book. She's chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. After we take a short break, we'll listen back to an interview with Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen on the 1950s TV series The Adventures of Superman. He died Sunday. This is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Getty Images. Great photography has the power to move culture, highlight injustice, bring understanding, and change minds. Getty Images believes that the difference between looking and seeing is the power of the image. Getty Images provides the highest quality collection of images from world-renowned artists, curated with expertise. So visit GettyImages.com and see what an image can do.
Jack Larson, who co-starred in the 1950s TV series The Adventures of Superman, died Sunday at the age of 87. He was 23 when he got the part of Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter at the Daily Planet, where he worked with reporters Lois Lane and Clark Kent, who was, of course, Superman in disguise. Jimmy and Lois were constantly getting themselves into fixes where they were rescued at the last minute by Superman. After his days of getting rescued by the Man of Steel, Larson went on to write plays and librettos. He collaborated with such prominent composers as Virgil Thomson, Ned Roram, Charles Fussell, and David Diamond. He was a producer of several films, including Bright Lights, Big City, The China Syndrome, The Paper Chase, and Urban Cowboy. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview I recorded with Jack Larson in 1993. He told me that when he got the offer to play Jimmy Olsen on Superman, he'd been trying to establish a stage career, but he was getting nowhere.
I wanted to go to Broadway, New York, here I come. I didn't have any money. You got equity minimum for doing a play. And I was offered the Superman television show, which was one of the first shows ever filmed. Nobody knew what it was. There had been no film television. Only live television. And so I was hesitant to do it, and the people that wanted me very much said, look, it's like doing a Saturday morning serial, for theater serials. No one will ever see it. You're a very difficult kid. You don't want another stock contract. You don't want this. You don't want that. You want to get to New York? Well, take the money and run and do this. So I signed on to play Jimmy Olsen in Superman. It didn't go on the air for 2 years. We shot that in the summer of 1951, summer and fall, and I was in New York working in live television when Superman went on the air, and it became instantly very popular, and my character became popular, and I became Jimmy Olsen.
Well, you were interested in writing, in serious acting, and here you were on Superman playing this golly gee whiz naive cub reporter. It sounds like you were really nothing like the character you were playing. Did you enjoy playing that kind of role? Did it get annoying after a while?
I loved playing Jimmy. And I now, all these years later, regard it as a fulfillment of myself as an actor. I think Jimmy was, it was my part. Being a pioneer in television like that, in film television, they were so busy technically learning how to film a show quickly that they let us all alone as performers. And they let me create Jimmy, and I had a wonderful time doing it and worked with first-rate character actors, people like Georgie Stone, Sterling Holloway, Elizabeth Patterson. And you learn from these people who were major actors from the theater and in films. And I wanted to do comedy and comedy bits, and they'd let me alone. And once I became popular, they really let me alone to just do what I wanted to do. So you were like a pioneer in the early days of silent films, a two-reel comedy, doing television.
How many times were you kidnapped as Jimmy Olsen?
Oh, I don't know, probably every third show I was kidnapped as Jimmy and had a bomb. If I was ever kidnapped, I was either tied to a chair with a bomb at my feet or sealed in a room somewhere that Superman couldn't see through because there was mysterious lead in the brick or something. But that never bothered me. What bothered me was the writers and the producers, they liked to have Jimmy nearly drown. And they used to like to get me wet, like put me in a cave, and the tide is coming in the cave, and the cave has bars, and Jimmy is going to be drowned. And the problem with that, I never mind being wet. I will do anything as an actor. But you get sick, because once they get you wet, if you've got work to do afterwards, you stay wet. And the next day work, if you're rescued, for instance, Superman would come in and rescue, tear back the bars of the cave and carry Jimmy out, who would say, golly, Superman, I never thought you'd get here in time. I thought I was a goner for sure. And I'd be carried outside dripping wet. Well, your next scenes, all your next work, the resolution, you're still wet. They come with a hose and wet you down. And I would always catch a cold. Sound stages are cold. And it drove me crazy. And they never cared. And I finally told them, it was about the second season and my 10th wet show. And I said, listen, I don't want to seem a spoil sport, but I don't like working sick. And I catch a cold in these cold sound stages, so quit. You can regard me from now on as a dry actor.
You know how earlier you were telling us that when you started working in music, when you started working with opera and art song, that you kept your Jimmy Olsen part of your life a secret because you thought it would hurt your credibility and people wouldn't want to work with you. During the part of your life where you were keeping Jimmy Olsen a secret, did you make up a past or did you just not talk about the past?
No, I didn't talk about it. And I was aware that people would stare at me in restaurants or people would come up and it would embarrass me to sign autographs or things. But nobody would say anything. So, and I didn't have a wide, you know, really wide circle of friends like that. My closest friend during all those years was Montgomery Clift, really. And Monty was very reclusive and socially, often we go out to dinner and stuff. But when you're forbidding like that, people don't bother you. And I was certainly forbidding. And as I said, when off time, I would grow a beard and do things. And I realized it was very neurotic behavior.
Years ago, it was just like the first year I was in radio. It was in the mid-70s, I think. I interviewed Noelle Neal, your co-star. She was.
Oh, did you?
She was Lois Lane.
Yes, she's a darling person.
Well, one of the questions I asked her was this. I said, I remember all these episodes where you were kidnapped and you were tied up and you were wriggling around while you were, you know, in bondage. And sometimes you'd be dressed in the chiffon robe and you were supposed to be sacrificed until Superman came and rescued you. And I said,
right.
You know, did you ever think about the kind of S&M type of image that was? And she said, we never thought about those kinds of things.
No.
Did you really never think about those kinds of things?
No, I really didn't. I know the show you're referring to, where the ancient cult kidnapped both of us in a tomb, and they stripped me. I'm in like a jock strap or something, little thing, and she's in a beautiful filmy thing, and we're tied to pillars or something, and they're going to kill us. And I guess it was wild S&M. I don't know. No, I never thought about it. We were too busy working. We never thought about a lot of things, you know. I always played the Jimmy just, let me see, dumb enough. I felt that Jimmy was so dumb that he couldn't tell Superman was Clark Kent because Clark Kent wore a pair of horn-rimmed glasses.
Right, right.
And I thought, if you're that unaware, and any kind of a thing. Once, actually, Clark Kent, there's one show where Jimmy's beside him, and Clark Kent has fallen through his shower door, and he's in bed, and Jimmy seems to be sharing the apartment at that time or something. He's taking care of him, and Clark Kent does not have on his glasses, and Jimmy doesn't even still recognize him as Superman. And I pointed it out to the director and the producer. I said, well, now, you know, here we are, and he doesn't have on these glasses because he's fallen through his shower, glass shower door. And they said, oh, don't think about it. That's opening up a can of peas. Just play the scene, so I did.
Jack Larson played Jimmy Olsen on The Adventures of Superman. He died Sunday at the age of 87. Our interview was recorded in 1993. After we take a short break, Maureen Corrigan will review Lauren Groff's new novel, Fates and Furies. It's the current selection of the NPR Morning Edition Book Club. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bleecker Street, presenting the new film Pawn Sacrifice. In a gripping true story set during the height of the Cold War, American chess prodigy Bobby Fischer, played by Tobey Maguire, finds himself caught between two superpowers when he challenges the Soviet Empire. Also starring Liev Schreiber and Peter Sarsgaard, Pawn Sacrifice chronicles Fischer's terrifying struggles with genius and madness, and the rise and fall of a kid from Brooklyn who captured the imagination of the world. Now playing.
Before we get back to Fresh Air, I want to tell you about a new NPR podcast called Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam. It premieres September 22nd with an episode exploring a phenomenon called switch tracking, when two people think they're talking about the same thing, but in reality are speeding down separate tracks. It usually does not end well. You can subscribe to Hidden Brain on the NPR One app, iTunes, or at npr.org/podcasts. Lauren Groff is a young writer who's already garnered serious acclaim for her novels The Monsters of Templeton and Arcadia. Her third novel, Fates and Furies, has just been published, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has more words of praise for Groff's writing, with some qualification. Here's her review.
Biographers of Charles Dickens tell us that even though his novels were published monthly, occasionally even weekly, in serial form, he would customarily work out their sprawling plots in his mind well in advance, sometimes making diagrams on great swaths of paper. I imagine that Lauren Groff, like Dickens, must have begun her new novel, Fates and Furies, by mentally mapping out an aerial view of its zigzagging, unflagging tour de force of a plot. For a medium-sized novel that focuses in tightly on two characters and their over 20-year marriage, Fates and Furies vacuum-packs so many complex narratives between its covers that you feel like you're reading one of those plot-heavy Victorian doorstoppers. And not only does Groff tell a multitude of stories, but she does so through a variety of genres. What starts off as a fairly realistic novel about domestic life digresses into chapters that read like plays and eventually morphs into a dark fairy tale that also borrows heavily from the conventions of the classic psychological suspense story. Wow. Despite the reservation I have about Fates and Furies, and more on that later, it is a marvel of language and design. The two main characters here are called Lotto, short for Lancelot, and Mathilde. They meet at Vassar in 1991. She's a solitary scholarship student, tall and fair, possessed of a somewhat offbeat beauty. He's a budding actor, charismatic and rich. They impulsively marry within a couple of weeks. Here are some of Lotto's happy, lusty thoughts about the future while he's on his honeymoon with Mathilde, consummating their marriage on a cold beach in Maine. He imagined a lifetime of making love on the beach until they were one of those ancient pairs speed walking in the morning, skin like lacquered walnut meat. Even old, he would waltz Mathilde into the dunes and have his way with her sexy, frail bird bones, the plastic hips, the bionic knee, this for eternity. Between his skin and hers, there was the smallest of spaces, barely enough for air, for this slick of sweat now chilling. Even still, a third person, their marriage, had slid in. Clearly, Groff turns a phrase as deftly as she twists and turns her plot. Fates and Furies is alive with wit, with language capable of shifting in the space of a sentence from the snappy to the tragic. The first half of the novel, called Fates, is told primarily from Lotto's perspective. It traces his marriage to Mathilde through its early years, when they survived paycheck to paycheck in a basement apartment in New York City, to Lotto's rise to international prominence as a playwright, to, well, let's stop there. The second half, Furies, is Mathilde's version of events, in which the scaffolding of their life story that Lotto has securely fixed in the reader's mind is dismantled, nuts, beams, and bolts, until all that remains is rubble. Ingenious, but my reservation about Fates and Furies derives from this fact. Groff basically has written a two-character story, and within a day of finishing this novel, I had trouble remembering those two characters' names. That's because Lotto and Mathilde are more like necessary devices rather than fully realized characters whose lives invite connection and concern. As engrossed as I was in the elaborate clashing tales of their marriage, I didn't find myself caring at all about them or believing in them for that matter. Granted, not every novel needs to be character-driven to be worth reading, and there are plenty of other reasons to read and admire Fates and Furies. It's just that, without the presence of compelling characters at its core, Groff's novel ends up being an austere, architectural achievement. There are certainly worse things for a novel to be, but there are also better.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. Tomorrow on Fresh Air,
we stand on the eve of a black revolution, brothers.
I'll talk with director Stanley Nelson about his new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It chronicles the rise of the Black Panthers in the 1960s and includes interviews with former Panthers as well as police officers who were in confrontations with them and an FBI agent who infiltrated the group. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.